I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. John Baldwin and Linda Beely join me now. They're accomplished photographers and adventurers who've chronicled their travels in a gorgeous new book, Soul of Wilderness, Mountain Journeys in Western BC and Alaska. It features their amazing photographs of the landscape in this part of the world, as well as their narration of their adventures through the coast mountains. They also reflect on the wilderness and how it does have a soul, and what that might teach us about the past, the present, and perhaps instruct us about the future. Linda Beely is an environmental engineer who has completed over 15 long ski mountaineering traverses. Her photography has been published in several notable magazines, catalogs, and displays. John Baldwin grew up in Vancouver and for over 40 years has completed numerous ascents and pioneered many remote long ski traverses. His previous books include Mountains of the Coast and Exploring the Coast Mountain on Skis. Visit johnbaldwin.ca for more. This new book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program from here in Vancouver today, John Baldwin and Linda Beely. Ms. Beely, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. Baldwin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So you both live in Vancouver full-time, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How often are you out of your house, say, and on an adventure?
Oh, quite often.
More than we're here.
Yeah. And so what keeps you in Vancouver, Linda?
That is actually a good question. I mean, Vancouver is actually kind of centrally located for a lot of the places we want to explore to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, for skiing and stuff, you can go south to, you know, Mount Baker or Coquihalla area or north. Like, there's actually quite a few places you can access pretty easily, and Vancouver is a good jumping off point for many amazing areas. There's actually a lot of great wilderness really pretty close to Vancouver.
And did you weren't from here originally, is that right?
Yeah, I was born in, well, Dawson Creek, B.C., but I kind of grew up in Calgary in the Rockies. And I do love the Rockies, but the coast mountains are truly wild, and there are so many places that very few people have ever been to, and big glaciers that you can traverse for weeks and weeks on end.
John, you grew up in Vancouver, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. Well, Burnaby, actually, but yeah, I grew up in the Lower Mainland, and that's part of the reason we're here. It's home and family and the ocean. But yeah, Vancouver is amazing because it's literally right at the southern end of the Coast Mountains. And they just start right here and go north.
Like all of us that grew up in this part of the world, you, John, saw these mountains at a young age, and I guess for you they had a certain attraction, didn't they?
But yeah, well, that's right. Not everyone looks at them the same way I do.
Yeah.
I don't know, just early on, I think it was a kid's birthday party. We went hiking around Seymour and then, you know, snowshoeing with scouts and so on, and I just became fascinated by the mountain environment and being up there and just seeing how wonderful it is, and that just grew and grew to all these trips we do.
Yeah, what interests me, Linda, is, I mean, there are mountains all over the place. I mean, where you grew up in Calgary, I'm sure, in Alberta, certainly there are mountains, but what sets apart this part of the world on the West Coast from elsewhere?
For the mountains?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, the coast mountains there's like lots of big ice fields, like really many, many ice fields that go all the way up from Vancouver to Alaska. And you can traverse these ice fields. You can do big, long traverses across these ice fields and climb peaks, you know, along the way. And they're more remote, like in the Rockies, you know, especially in the area around Banff or so. There's many, many people in those areas. those mountains may be a little harder to like on the coast mountains. You can in the summer you can do these traverses along the ridges and just keep going for hundreds of kilometers along these ridges because they're maybe a little gentler.
Mm-hmm.
the other thing that sets it apart is it there, you know, between Vancouver and Alaska, there's only roads and three places across these mountains, so they're huge areas of wilderness that are becoming very rare, you know, even around anywhere else in the world.
And so they're the same as they were hundreds of years ago, are they?
Yeah, they're virtually. I mean, there's places you go up there where you know, I mean, there's no you wouldn't know that there's any Europeans that have come to North America.
Hmm.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
And this is globally significant wilderness area that we have on the coast. Like, if you look at the map of the world and where human impacts are, you know, where humans are and there's impacts, there's very few places that don't have human impacts. And like John said, there's very few roads and very few human settlements in this area, in this range.
So we're all concerned about climate change and its effect. I mean, when you go to the places that you do go to in this book, at least, do you see its effects?
Absolutely. Yeah. We're on glaciers a lot, and glaciers are they're a sort of a prime indicator, sort of obvious indicator of climate change. I mean, they're affected, dramatically, and we've seen that. You know, where glaciers used to come down, now they've moved back, 5 kilometers or more, and there might be a big lake that used to be buried under the ice.
Yeah. I just realized in the course of this conversation that there are people listening to us who perhaps haven't picked up the book and don't know exactly where you go to in the book. And would you give us sort of a map as to the places that you take us to in Soul of Wilderness?
Oh, well, yeah. So if you imagine the Coast Mountains starting at Vancouver and just running all the way up the western edge of B.C., all the way up to the Alaska Panhandle and the Yukon border, that's the Coast Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the focus of our trips.
Yeah, and how long ago did you do all of these trips?
The pictures in the book have been taken over the last 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you certainly have to plan for something like this, don't you? I mean, this is not something you just pick up on a weekend, grab a bag, say, and go off. You need to. I mean, some people who read this may think it's easy, and because when you read what you've written, there are a lot of challenges on these trips of yours.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, obviously you can go for a short, a day hike or a weekend hike from Vancouver fairly easily, but to venture further, and plan for multiple weeks, it takes us quite a bit of preparation, organizing food and figuring out our routes, and where we're going to start, how we're going to get picked up at the end.
And you may look at like aerial photographs,
mm-hmm.
sort of get a feel for what the terrain might be like, and then these days now you can use a little bit of Google Earth to look at the terrain. But you never really, what I find interesting of these traverses is there's usually some complex terrain that we need to get through, but we're never really sure what it's going to be like till we get there.
Yeah.
Because things change and conditions change, and the glaciers are changing so rapidly too. So that's kind of the exciting part. There's always a few areas of uncertainty about the traverse, and that's what we work to make it through. But most of it's pretty easy terrain to travel through.
Yeah, I was wondering, as reading the book, the sort of gear that you have to pack. I mean, is that a lot of stuff to carry? I mean, it probably is, right?
Yeah. I mean, the heaviest thing is food, really.
Yeah.
But no, for sure we have to have tents and warm sleeping bags and clothes and
glacier gear.
Glacier gear, ropes and ice axes for traveling on the glaciers. Ski gear if it's in the winter.
Crampons. And on the ski trips, to make it easier, we have these plastic crazy carpets,
uh-huh.
That kids would use to slide down, and
yeah.
we converted them to little toboggans that we tow behind us. And then they're quite light, so if there's an area where we can't tow them or something, we can wrap them up. They weigh about a pound, wrap them up and stick them on our packs, and if it's an area that's too complex for towing, so they're kind of ideal.
Yeah, and the considerations for safety and danger that you might encounter along the way, I mean, those are probably foremost in your mind, are they?
Yeah, we're always careful for sure because we're way out there and you don't want anything, any accidents to happen. So yeah, we carry sort of first aid gear and all that sort of thing. But we also carry a satellite phone for an emergency if anything was to go wrong.
Yeah, it's one thing to protect something to honor it because it's been there forever, it's beautiful. But for the both of you, these places that you go to in the book, in BC and Alaska, they take on something else. I mean, they altogether have a different meaning, and as the title of the book suggests, they do have a soul, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess for us, that everyone, we're all sitting on the earth. Whether we live in a city and don't think anything about nature, we're all we're sitting on the ground. We're connected to the earth, and this way people say Mother Earth. It, that's really what it is. And I think things like climate change are just pointing us back to that fact that we can't forget that we live on the earth, we're part of it, and it has this And then it has this soul, and that's what we connect with. And so I think that that sort of underlies any sort of urge to protect things just for that reason.
Why is it we don't realize that, or everyone realize that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, if you look at different cultures around the world, that's not necessarily the case. Other cultures, nature is sort of more predominantly part of their culture. And then Western culture, I don't know. I mean, the word wilderness itself, the roots of it sort of mean wild wood. It's where the wild animals live. It's always been, almost by definition, it's something that's, outside of the sphere of our culture. I don't totally have an answer why, but obviously not everybody feels that way. Everyone sort of, a lot of people go out in the wilderness, they appreciate mm-hmm. nature, but sort of as a culture, really is a bit lacking compared to sort of other cultures.
Yeah, and Linda, this idea of soul, what does it look like for you?
Well, it's sort of it's almost like when you hear people say, they need to replenish their soul, they need to, honor their soul, like getting out in the wilderness, like you just feel refreshed and alive and kind of renewed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a place that you just want to keep going back to. Like, it just really makes you feel, refreshed and alive. And everyone, almost everyone I know that goes out, whether it's a short hike or a longer hike, just thinks, why don't I make time for more of this? Why am I not getting, keeping that balance in my life to get out and appreciate, appreciate nature and wilderness and wildlife. And I hate to use the word spiritual, but it is like this like wonderful, beautiful feeling that you get when you're out there and what you come across and see, whether it's, anyone that's seen an orca, a whale, or anyone that's come across a bear or a mountain goat, is always really excited about that.
Yeah, see, to be honest, not that I wouldn't, I wouldn't myself go on any of these adventures that you guys go on. It's not just, it's not how I spend my week or my weekends, but I can't tell you just how moved I was by the photographs, by the narration in the book as to where you go to, because one realizes that just how beautiful this province is and how big it is. Because I'm lived in Vancouver my whole life, and I tend to think that BC is, and unfortunately I'm one of those people that think that BC is just what's in my neighborhood, say, or what's close to me here in Vancouver. But in reading your book, I realized just how close we are to all of this wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, no, yeah, thank you very much. I mean, that's for us, is one of the motivations in writing the book, is, we go to all these places and we see them. But it's wonderful to share that with people, and obviously we don't expect everyone to go out there, and it's a big deal to organize these trips and spend all the time and energy to do them and learn how to do them, but by sharing it, we can just show people that what is there, and so they don't have to do that, but at the same time they can appreciate it
and be proud of what we have, and to
absolutely
to care about it and to protect it.
Yeah. Just in terms of how cold it is, because, I complain about how cold it is in Vancouver some days. do you have a different feeling towards, say, temperature, because you've been to these places, to these mountains, where, say, the weather's a little bit different than it is here on the coast?
Yeah, that's it.
I think you adjust a bit. Like, I think part of it, you acclimatize. Just like living in Vancouver in the winter, you start to get used to the lower temperatures and stuff. And then, suddenly if there was like a 15-degree day, it would seem hot. But in the summer, if it's been 20 degrees and then suddenly it goes, down to 10, you'd feel cold. So you do kind of acclimatize to, to these temperatures and being out there. And then we do what we have to do to adjust.
Well, and the other thing is, if you're well prepared and have good clothing for it, then that's a whole, and then it's not so cold and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Also, the trips we do, like on the snowy pictures, maybe look cold because all the snow, but we tend to do the long trips in the spring, and so it's not, you know, we're not going to the Arctic. It's not the dead of winter.
Yeah. Yeah, you just realize that because I mean, when there was that cold snap a few weeks ago, it was really cold. But then when it started to rain, or if it does snow, the temperature I guess increases, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So yeah, because I mean, when I look at the pictures in the book and I see, you know, all this ice and all this snow, I think, man, that's cold, and that's probably why I wouldn't want to be there. But I guess as Linda says, you acclimatize.
And then we have the gear, like we don't even think about it. I think like we're constantly adjusting what we wear. Like we carry, you know, like layers of equipment and layers of clothes, and then one being warmer and less warm. And I think you just made me realize how much we are constantly adjusting what we're wearing to, you know, to stay, you know, like not too warm, not too cold. And I think you also could acclimatize a bit to it.
Yeah, the photographs in the book, as I said in the introduction, is breathtaking. But because you've been there and you took the photos, does it really capture how remarkable it is to be up there?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's sort of the age-old question of photography in general. Yeah, it's hard to, you know, it is hard to capture what we see out there, and we're always striving to do that. You know, if you look at your pictures right when you get home, you're not sure if you caught what it. But then you look at them later, and then you start to realize that they do capture some of the essence of being there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It. I mean, there are places that you go to in the book that I'm thinking, wow. And then I realize, you know, the photograph only captures so much. But you were there, you know, you had the whole 360 experience of it, and that must have been just 100 times more remarkable than, say, my experience looking at, or 1,000 times more remarkable than my experience looking at the book in my house.
I think that's true to a certain degree, because when you're actually somewhere, you have the, you know, the wind, the sounds, the
smells,
the temperature, the, you know, and then you're 360, right?
Mm-hmm.
And where are you? 360, and that feeling. But that's partly why we like those pictures of, or I like those pictures anyway, of the, when you have a small person in a big landscape, and that's what it feels like. It's just so awe-inspiring, this big area, and you're just a tiny part of it, but you're part of it, but it's vast.
Yeah, and you get the perspective of time, don't you? Because as I said earlier, these places have been here thousands and thousands of years before us, and we're only here for a small blip of that.
Yeah.
That we can be quite affecting, can't we? I mean, in terms of how, I mean, just look at climate change, but how a small portion of time can affect long term.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you, the animals that you encounter along the way, the creatures that you see, do you find that there are some that are particularly scary or intimidating?
Yeah. Well, obviously, grizzly bears. We see them in the Alpine. They spend the summers up there, and yeah, obviously, bears are intimidating. And you know, we travel in groups and carry bear spray. And
yeah, there's a shot in the book, Linda, where you've got your foot next to a print.
And you
realize the size of these bears.
Oh yeah, no, I actually love that. Yeah, I love when you. Yeah, you can compare, your hand or your foot to a print or whatever,
Did you get a sense of how long ago that print was there as to when you were there?
Oh yeah, often.
Ooh, I think that picture in the book was maybe the day, but that same day or the day before.
Really? Yeah.
Well, we had seen a bear from a camp close to that, and then we're always really wary of giving the bear space to go around us if they look like they're traveling through. And we do a really good job of trying to keep, like, the food we bring, keep the smells down. Like bears are attracted to smells.
Yeah.
We always make sure we don't have any soaps and stuff like that smell strong and attract them. And probably the most, the one thing that, bears we love to see, the one thing that's kind of tricky is the younger bears are curious, and they're the ones that are probably the most unpredictable.
Mm.
So we see a 2-3-year-old grizzly or something are the ones that were most on their own. So
yeah,
they already left their mother. Those are the ones that were most just keep a close eye and give them the most respect. And
yeah, so what's the distance then? How close have you gotten, say, to a grizzly bear?
Oh, maybe 100 feet or something.
Yeah.
I mean, depends on the trip we're doing. We're not always in the same area as the bears. And, certainly on the ski trips, we rarely see a bear.
Yeah.
And the summer trips, if we're very high in the mountains, we might not see a bear at all. But if we come down into the meadows or the areas they are, then we consider it sort of lucky. If it's a real treat if we see a bear. It might only be twice on a trip or something that we'll see one.
And wolverines, are they rarer?
They're very rare. We've seen them a few times in the Alpine. I've seen them maybe half a dozen times as we're up high in the snow, and they'll be running across a glacier, to go from one valley to another. But I read once that even biologists that have been studying wolverines for decades have sometimes never seen one in the wild.
Hmm.
Sort of how rare it is to see one.
Yeah. And I'm sure you encounter sort of curious and friendly creatures, do you?
Oh, mountain goats are a great example. They're climbing around these ridges, and sometimes we just come upon them, and yeah, they're kind of curious, and they scamper off. They don't like to be near us, but they're no threat at all.
Yeah, there's one shot in the book of them going up this rather steep incline or this cliff, and you wonder how they do it.
Well, yeah, we wonder how they do it.
They're amazing. Yeah.
We couldn't do it.
And
yeah.
And here we are stumbling along with a big pack with clothing and tents and sleeping bags, and they just walk around and they live up there. Right?
Yeah. Well, by the way, what sort of food do you bring?
So we like to eat reasonably well, so we tend to dehydrate a lot of stuff ourselves at home. Like we'll dehydrate, we'll bring a rice dish or something. So we'll bring real rice.
Yeah.
And then at home we will have dehydrated maybe eggplant and carrots and onions and fresh ginger and stuff like that, maybe chickpeas, and then we'll make a curry rice, dinner in the field, and then for lunch lots of cheese and bread.
and nuts and dried fruit.
Important part of these trips is that we're not carrying too much or too little. Like you need just the right amount of food, and you don't want to carry too much; it's too heavy, and you don't want too little, and you're too hungry. So we've kind of over the years have really dialed down exactly how many grams per person a day of various items.
Hmm.
But
yeah.
That helps we use these spreadsheets before we do the trips to measure and weigh everything so we're pretty close to what we need.
Yeah, I'll bet you have to, because you don't want to run out in the middle of one of, in the middle of nowhere, say.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, and there's a real trade-off. You sort of, you don't want to run out, but then if you bring too much, you could have brought, say, a camera or, other things instead of the food.
So how does it work when you guys are back home? Do you then just gorge and indulge?
Well, I don't usually ever lose any weight on these trips.
Yeah.
I don't know how John does it. I usually lose a little bit of weight. I can lose up to 10 pounds on a trip, and I'm about 128 pounds.
Uh-huh.
But you're definitely hungry after you've been exercising hard and outside for days, weeks, and you come back, and you can eat pretty well. We're pretty hungry.
Food tastes really good after you've had a... And then the amazing thing about these trips is really most of our stuff is quite mushy, out there. It's cooked. It's all cooked food, right?
Yeah.
Like you're not biting into an apple or a carrot or a salad. And so those are the things that we... really crave when we come home is the fresh, fresh food with texture and
the sounds.
And the worst thing was one trip on a 3-week trip, we were stuck in a snowstorm near the end of the trip, and some one of the people on the trip had a gardening magazine, and there was this whole thing on salads at the end, and I borrowed it in the tent, and I could not read it. I could not look at those pictures. I just couldn't bear to look at all this fresh food.
So this even just listening to you just now, you learn a lot about yourselves, don't you? I mean, you learn about what you need, what you don't need, and really what you need to get along and survive without, say, wasting a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, like even like your like I say, everything has to be like our clothes too. Like we really minimize.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so for a trip, we might have one pair of underwear for 3 weeks, and then and if you get a chance to wash it, great. But I mean, we really minimize the number of socks and the clothes and the food and everything. And yeah, we have one spoon, one cup. That's it for utensils and.
Well, then the camping. That's what I love about these places we camp. I mean, you sort of. You know, we don't carry much, but you just make yourself comfortable by where you camp. You know, you find a place that's maybe sheltered, a place where there's water close by, or, you know, maybe there's some rocks to sit on, and you just make your comfort from what you find.
This is someone I've had on the program a few times, Roy Henry Vickers. I remember one time he talked about the Stikeen River and just how important that is to ourselves as British Columbians and the sword, and there is one trip that in the book that you go there. And what's the line, and I can't remember, I think it was Mark Hume, about the Stikeen and just how vital it is and important it is to us?
Yeah, I think his quote is, or one of the things he said is, it's one of the greatest stretches of running water on the planet.
Yeah, yeah. And it, I mean, it's so important to remember that, isn't it?
It's just, yeah, it's astounding.
Yeah,
and something that's interesting about the Stikeen River is on so it borders the U.S. and Canada, the Panhandle,
mm-hmm.
and B.C., and the Alaska side is protected. They've got it's a protected area. In B.C. right now, there's still lots of proposals for mining and stuff, especially these mines that could impact the water quality, which impact the fish, which is the salmon, which is a really important. Part of the ecosystem in that area.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we like to think we're rather progressive on some things, but we still have a long ways to go, don't we? Especially in here in BC.
Yeah, that's the thing where I think we take a lot of this for granted.
Yeah.
We just think it's like that everywhere, and there's tons of wilderness out there. But if you really start to sort of look what else there is around the world and how special these places we have here are. It puts it in a perspective where you can see that more.
I mean, parts of these of BC really, in my mind, should be a World Heritage Site.
Mm, yeah.
They're really globally significant. This is really world-class wilderness and nature and ecosystems that the world should be looking at to protect.
And Linda, are you generally hopeful?
To
our future, say?
I'm there some days.
Yeah.
Well, that's a tough question. Generally, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that, we're people care about these things. Like just with the book, we get a good response in our slideshows. People care, and people, like I say, really love nature. And like anyone that's seen a whale, from a ferry or wherever, they're so excited to see that wildlife and that nature. They're so excited. It's like a highlight of their year.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can't imagine, I can't imagine us living without wildlife or that nature. And people are pretty excited about it. People really care about it.
John, what have you found in terms of in the course of your travels, in the course of putting this book together, about the wilderness and what it teaches us about imagination?
Oh, that's a tough question. Yeah.
Because the chapter at the end of the book talks about just... And it's something that I never really thought about when I'm outdoors, even just how we're affected by what's around us and what we see, and how that opens up a different door in terms of our imagination and what we can imagine and what's possible. Say,
yeah, I mean, there's a quote in the book about from Einstein actually, who says that I forget exactly how it goes, but it basically just stresses how important imagination is in terms of relating to your world. For me, it kind of, I see it as something that, when I was a kid, you used to play on the beach and you'd just the ability to imagine things and say, move your toys or whatever, and sort of imagine them as being things. I think if you carry that through to an adult, the imagination allows you to sort of, look at nature and the mountains and so on and build this image, if you will, in your head But not just sort of, it's on one hand, you can imagine, that allows you to build sort of imagine what the other side of the mountain would look like, or look at a map and imagine what it's going to be like. But imagination, it goes even beyond that in terms of you know, it also ties in with the feelings that you have about the place and just, you know, what the earth is, and I think that's key. That's a big part of sort of interacting with something, with the landscape. And
yeah. Yeah, Linda, what's the next adventure for you guys?
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, that's a common question we get. We always have ideas. Like we already have a plan for another spring ski traverse, probably up by Bella Coola area.
Uh-huh.
But immediately, our plan is just, we love winter, love snow, love skiing, and we just got back from 5 days, and we'll be going out in the next few days again. And just, I love being immersed in the fresh, you know, the fresh wonderment of snow that we're getting right now, and seeing around us, and that blanket, how it covers everything, and, you know, it's on the trees, and just love being out in winter and snow and in the mountains that we have here close to home.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thank you both for your time today. As someone who, as I said, doesn't do any of this stuff, it was marvelous. Living vicariously through your adventures, it's also a wonderful meditation about this place. Linda, John, it's a great book. Thanks for this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Continued good luck and all the best for the holidays. Happy Christmas and New Year to both of you.
Thank you too. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Soul of the Wilderness, Mountain Journeys in Western BC and Alaska. That's the name of the book, and it's from Harbor Publishing. Do pick it up. Linda Beely and John Baldwin join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.